The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards with another edition of the Armchair Traveler from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Over the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Washington Post. And let's take a look here. We're going to begin our journey today reminding you that neither the Triangle Radio Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we're going to be reading. They are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Email and e-books are just a couple of the many monikers denoting our electronic information age. What about e-travel? Think about that one for a minute. And when you think about it, Armchair Traveler would certainly fall under that label. Earlier this year, while traveling with family in the Northwest, writer Laura Randall encountered a Seattle Museum's tech bonanza from classic video games to virtual reality. Her article was published in the July 26, 2018 issue of the Washington Post, so let's see how e-travel works in Seattle. It doesn't look like much from the outside, especially cloaked in Seattle's typical gray mist. But inside, the three-story warehouse that contains living computers, museum, and labs is a unique convergence of new and old technology that shows in a fun, hands-on way how ideas can improve and evolve over time. This may be the only place in the world where one can take a virtual ride in a 3D-printed self-driving car, then head upstairs to play Space Invaders on a wood veneer Atari 2600 console while reclining on a plaid chair. The museum began in 2012 as a modest repository for Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen's collection of old computers, a PDP-10 from his Harvard days, a working MITS Altair 8800, a Tandy Radio Shack TRS-80. It started adding and restoring donated machines and now has the largest publicly accessible collection of vintage operating computers in the world. And if I may inject just momentarily, unfortunately, Mr. Allen passed away yesterday, if you've saw the headlines on the day that we're recording our program. But he made quite a contribution to this museum. He was 65, I understand. Getting back to our museum, operating is the key word here. The institution's motto is, most museums put glass in front of their stuff. We put a chair, as they say. Indeed, one of the few things encased in glass is a tattered Atari version of the 1980s arcade classic Defender, excavated from a landfill in 2013 by a Canadian entertainment company as part of the documentary Atari Game Over. In 2016, Living Computers tacked Labs onto its name and expanded with a floor dedicated to new technology trends such as virtual reality and digital art, drawing subtle connections to the ways they complement the older machines and exhibits. On a visit to Seattle last spring, my family added the place to a packed day of sightseeing, but quickly realized that we would need more than the 2 hours we had allotted. We ended up staying until closing time at 5 p.m., along with a few other small groups who seemed as surprised and pleased as we were to have stumbled onto this unsung treasure south of downtown. Like most first-time visitors, we started on the ground floor in a modern tech bonanza of telepresence robots, magnetic battery-powered building blocks, and a digital art studio with a giant mural that responded with music and movement as we walked by it. We observed a decade's worth of virtual reality headsets arranged on a wall as carefully as shards of ancient Egyptian pottery at the British Museum, and took a virtual ride in a Strati, the world's first 3D-printed electric car. Things got even more interesting on the second floor. Home to the museum's vintage collection, this is anything but a quick walkthrough of dusty machines and rose-colored Microsoft history exhibits. Microcomputers such as the Commodore PET and Compact Desk Pro 386S share space with an operating IBM punch card machine from the 1960s. And when I read that initially working on our program today, did that bring back memories? Because I remember using those things back in the 60s, not to date myself. The CDC 6500, an 8-ton supercomputer used in the 1960s to research topics including the workings of nuclear physics and the causes of common coal, was resuscitated by museum engineers and now sits in a climate-controlled cooling room along with Xerox Sigma-9 and other big iron computers of that era. The Apple II version of the Oregon Trail game is available to play, as are dozens of other classics such as Donkey Kong, Super Breakout, Pac-Man, and Missile Command. Exhibits explain in easy but not pandering language how Allen and Bill Gates built Microsoft, accompanied by their 1974 resumes and the traffic data machine that was the base of their first company. And now the programming of early machines such as the Altair 8800 required the painstaking entry of ones and zeros via toggle switches. Well, women's contributions to early computer industry, like those of Grace Hopper, a U.S. Navy Rear Admiral and pioneering programmer, are woven smoothly into the fabric of the room, not marginalized or given a separate exhibit. John and I challenged the kids to Space Invaders, Pong, and other games of our childhood, reveling in both nostalgia and amusement at hearing them complain about the stiff keyboards. Then we all broke out on our own to explore. John played Earl Weaver baseball and a Commodore Amiga 500. Jack, age 13, played chess against a 1965 Digital Equipment Corporation PDP-8 computer. If you win, the museum takes a Polaroid and puts you on its wall of fame, while Theo, age 9, figured out how to play Frogger on the Apple II, at least until he discovered the living room setup with an Xbox version of the popular football game Madden 15. This has since been replaced with an Atari Flashback console with built-in games including Centipede and Arcade Pong. Well, next to the 21st century living room is a cubicle that mirrors a late 1970s den, complete with an Atari 2600 console, shag carpeting, and a metal peacock wall hanging that every 50-something child of suburbia will recognize. Talk about returning in a time warp here, huh? Well, the computer renovation room was also a revelation. Floor-to-ceiling shelves of donated hardware and software items, 3.5-inch disk drives, joysticks, cassette tape recorders, computer mice as big as library books. Similar in fashion to natural history museums that showcase paleontologists working on the latest fossil acquisitions, visitors can often watch engineers in the process of restoring or maintaining a range of machines, such as an IBM mainframe, and donated data processors in many computers. Sometimes, when they can't bring something back from the dead, they'll create emulators or simulations of computers that allow users to run old programs as they would on the original one. We ended up spending so much time on the second floor that we only had time for a drive-by of the mezzanine level, where a game maker space lets you experiment with making your own video games, and an Internet of Things table highlights connections between electronic devices and everyday items, such as light switches. Theo managed to get in a few verbal commands to Alexa and an Amazon device before the lights dimmed in warning that it was almost closing time. Amazon.com founder and chief executive Jeffrey Bezos owns the Washington Post, they insert here, which is, as I said earlier, this is from the Post. Back in the car, fighting rush hour traffic, his car streamed out of the Starbucks headquarters next door, the kids asked if we could return the next day. That wasn't possible, but I was glad that we had made this museum as part of our first family trip to Seattle. In this age of daily wars over screen time with its deleterious effects on family time and relationships, the four of us somehow managed to connect through technology thanks to the museum's thoughtful and wide net approach. I'm pretty sure we'll be back someday for more rounds of Oregon Trail and Frogger. By the way, Laura Randall is based in Los Angeles. And if you'd like to go visit the museum, Living Computers Museum Plus Labs, it's found at 2245 First Avenue South in Seattle. And livingcomputers.org is their website, so you can get information there. That's livingcomputers.org. The museum is in Seattle's SoDo neighborhood between Safeco Stadium and the Starbucks headquarters. Its current special exhibit, Totally 80s Rewind, includes a recreated video arcade, middle school computer programming classroom, and wood-paneled basement den. It runs through December 31st. Check the website for other special events, such as FEMS and educational workshops, open 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., Wednesday to Sunday, 10 a.m. to 8 p.m., first Thursday of every month, and a small free parking lot is available. The admission is $16. Children 5 and younger are free, and I would bet you that if you flew into the Seattle airport and then took the SafeTac, that's their SeaTac, rather, that's their little train that runs from the airport to downtown Seattle and goes right by the stadium. And if you got off at that point and then probably walked about a block, you could be there. So that'd be something you could plan on doing if you're headed towards Seattle. So lots of fun there. Lots of fun. Wow. Well, writer Alexander Petchy will now take us from the electronic to the eclectic Cleveland itinerary, which makes for a perfect weekend getaway, according to the editors. Her article featured in the September 27, 2018 issue of the Washington Post. A blonde, bespectacled boy of about six stands alone on a wooden staircase, his arms and legs swimming in an oversized bright pink bunny costume, complete with long ears that stick straight up from a fuzzy hood pulled over his head. He's looking around impassively when, "Give me a pink nightmare," his mother calls from the foot of the stairs, her cell phone camera at the ready, and the boy immediately folds his arms against his chest and pulls his face into a petulant frown, scowling at his mother over the top of his wire-rimmed glasses. If this scene feels familiar, it's for good reason. We were in Cleveland, Ohio, inside the house where they filmed parts of the 1983 cult classic A Christmas Story. And I was watching a doppelganger for the main character, Ralphie, reenact one of the film's most famous moments. This diehard little fan wasn't the only person in costume, however, as we spotted at least six pink bunnies, mostly adults, over the course of our visit. "The house is fully interactive," our tour guide Paige told the roughly 25 people who had crowded into the house's small living room. "You can try on hats, you can pick up that major award like you want it, and you can hide under the sink." I didn't expect that watching my husband climb gleefully into a wooden cabinet under a kitchen sink would be a highlight of my summer vacation, but I guess Cleveland is nothing if not surprising. After all, when family and friends heard that our big summer plans consisted of a weekend trip to Cleveland, they all asked the same thing: why? It was a valid question with an easy answer. My husband Brian turned 40 earlier this year, so I wanted his Christmas gift to reflect the milestone. When I saw that A Christmas Story house had become a tourist attraction dedicated to the movie, a leg lamp illuminated inside my brain. I realized that Cleveland might just provide his ideal weekend, one filled with baseball, breweries, rock and roll, and a heavy helping of childhood nostalgia. It was a valid question with an easy answer, as I said, and after a quick nonstop flight from Boston, we dropped our bags at our hotel and walked about a half mile to the shore of Lake Erie and the glass pyramid of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where we found the flag at half staff and Aretha Franklin songs blaring from the outdoor plaza. The Queen of Soul, the first woman inducted into the Rock Hall, had died just hours before our arrival. Her music accompanied us throughout the day, playing in all of the museum's common areas as we wound through the seven-level shrine to rock. The museum's holdings are extensive and often jaw-dropping, ranging from the iconic Michael Jackson's rhinestone-encrusted glove, Elvis's army uniform, John Lennon's round wire-rimmed glasses, to the ostentatious David Bowie's Ziggy Stardust costumes, Flavor Flav's a clock necklace, and the Supremes feathered and sequined gowns. And there was one item that made a tangle of conflicted emotions bubble up in my stomach: Kurt Cobain's death certificate. Taking a picture of it didn't feel right, but I also couldn't help getting down on my knees to read it more closely. But perhaps nothing tugged at my writerly heartstrings more than seeing handwritten lyrics to songs like "London Calling," "Purple Haze," "God Only Knows," and "Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds," marred with crossouts and revisions and scribbled on paper that was crumpled, stained, or ripped hastily from notebooks. By the time we left the Rock Hall that afternoon, the museum had already sprung into tribute mode for Franklin, adding one of her glittered gowns to its in memoriam section, which itself was added this year as part of a museum revamp and playing host to hordes of TV news crews. A couple of days later, after a tour of Market Garden Brewery in the trendy Ohio City neighborhood, we watched Clevelanders pay tribute to another legend. Retired Indians baseball great Jim Thome was at Progressive Field for a pregame ceremony that included retiring his number 25. All that hometown pride didn't prevent the Baltimore Orioles from beating the Indians, though, something that we as Red Sox fans took in stride from our bleacher seats. A few blocks from the baseball stadium, we found ourselves drinking in a basement and on a rooftop on East Street, a pedestrian-only thoroughfare lined with restaurants, shops, and entertainment venues. Underneath white bistro lights strung across the street between the buildings, we walked among outdoor tables and buskers, searching for a place to hang out for a bit. First, we descended a flight of stairs into Society Lounge, a glamorous throwback to the sophisticated cafe society of yesteryear. Woefully underdressed, I enjoyed a meticulously handcrafted New York sour cocktail at the bar before heading across the street to another night spot, this one on a roof. From the rooftop patio of the Greenhouse Tavern, I sipped a glass of rosé and watched the people ambling around below us as they enjoyed Cleveland's laid-back nightlife. But back to those pink bunnies. I had always thought that Brian's fervent love of A Christmas Story, not to mention his ability to recite Ralphie's entire plea for a Red Ryder BB gun from memory, was a quirk peculiar to him, but as we arrived at the house, I learned otherwise. All afternoon, a steady stream of tourists filed in and out of the house, where they roamed and posed with decor and detail straight from the 1940s set film. There was a hand-cranked washing machine in the kitchen, Rafi's homework that earned him a C+, and a Red Ryder comic book in his bedroom, a bar of teeth-marked red soap in the bathroom like the one Ralphie's mother used to wash out his mouth, a little orphan Annie decoder pen on a small table, the longed-for BB gun under a crooked Christmas tree. And, of course, there was the major award that Ralphie's old man won, a huge lamp in the shape of a woman's fishnet stockinged leg standing in the window. Across the street, a museum held even more movie props and memorabilia, including its many bad reviews, which are proudly hung on the walls. We also learned that diehard fans could rent the house for overnight stays. You can get free rein of the whole house overnight, Page said, and that its owner was also remodeling the home next door, known to fans of the movie as the Bumpus House, into overnight accommodation slated to open October 1st. Just when I thought the afternoon couldn't get any weirder, we saw yet another bunny, this one wearing heavy black boots and a police vest over his pink fur suit, a pair of cuffs bouncing off his chest as he danced wildly in front of the house to the Justin Timberlake song Can't Stop the Feeling. The Greater Cleveland Regional Transit Authority police were filming a lip-sync challenge video. For us, it was the last of many surprises in a city filled with them. By the way, Pesci is a writer based in New Hampshire, and she has a website, alexandrapesci.contently.com. That's Alexandra spelled alexandrapecci.contently.com. And if you'd like to go, here's some suggestions on where to stay. Hampton Inn, Cleveland downtown. It's at 1460 East 9th Street. HamptonInn3.Hilton.com gets you more information online. That's HamptonInn3.Hilton.com. A centrally located hotel between Progressive Field, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and First Energy Stadium. Rooms start at $179. And then, how about somewhere to eat? How about the Greenhouse Tavern? Does that sound good? You'll find that at 2038 East 4th Street. And online, you can just check them out at thegreenhousetavern.com. That's thegreenhousetavern.com. Creative, locally sourced fare from Chef Jonathan Sawyer. This has a street-level restaurant and rooftop bar and patio. Dinner menu selection start at $9. Then there's the Market Garden Brewery at 1947 West 25th Street. And online, you can check them out at marketgardenbrewery.com. That's marketgardenbrewery, all one word, .com. Brew pub with beer fights and a local beer on tap, plus flatbreads, sandwiches, tacos, and other comfort food entrees. Shareable plates start at $5. Then we have the Society Lounge at 2063 East 4th Street. SocietyCleveland.com puts you in touch with what they offer. That's SocietyCleveland.com. Sophisticated retro-style bar with craft cocktails and a small food menu. Small bites start at $5. Seems like they have a lot of $5 items in Cleveland, huh? Well, back to the West Side Market is our next stop at 1979 West 25th Street. And you can check them out at westsidemarket.org. Westsidemarket.org. Public market with food stalls featuring fresh produce, fish, pasta, flowers, meats, baked goods, and favorites like Bariogi Palace, Maha's Falafel, Campbell's Popcorn Shop, and J&J Chedra Meats. and about what to do. Well, of course, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is high on the list. You find that at 1100 Rock and Roll Boulevard, rockhall.com. It's the information line for you on the internet, rockhall.com. The museum celebrates all things rock music and features exhibits dedicated to music and memorabilia from rock legends. Open daily except Thanksgiving and Christmas. General admission is $26. And then, of course, there's the Christmas Story House and Museum. That's at 3159 West 11th Street in Cleveland. ChristmasStoryHouse.com is where you find more information online. ChristmasStoryHouse.com. A house and museum dedicated to the 1983 film A Christmas Story. Open daily except major holidays, including Labor Day, Thanksgiving, New Year's Day, and ironically, Christmas. Check the website for the calendar and days open and special events. Fans can also book overnight accommodations, and those bookings start at $395 a night. General admission is $11.50. And if you want more information about other things to do and see in Cleveland, check it out at thisiscleveland.com. That's thisiscleveland.com. Whoa, I'm telling you. They just have a lot of fun there in Cleveland, don't they? Well, time for us to combine the eclectic and electronic, and we're going to head to California in order to look at the future of travel. New York Times writer Katie Metz recently discovered that Silicon Valley experiments with autonomous flying. Now, this article was published in the September 2nd, 2018 issue of the News and Observer. At our dateline is Tracy, California. At a tiny airport in the dusty flatlands east of San Francisco in July, a red and white helicopter lifted gently into the air, hovering a few feet over the tarmac. It looked like any other helicopter except for the small black cube attached to its nose. Local officials spent the week testing this aircraft for a new emergency service due for launch in January that will respond to 9/11 calls via the air. But as this helicopter moves police officers and medical workers over the San Joaquin Valley, it will feed a more ambitious project. That black cube is part of a growing effort to build small passenger aircraft that can fly on their own. I'll repeat that just so you make sure you heard me correctly. To build small passenger aircraft that can fly on their own. Today, the helicopter is flown by seasoned pilots, but the new emergency service will be operated by Skyrise, a Silicon Valley startup that intends to augment small helicopters and other passenger aircraft with hardware and software that allow for autonomous flight, leaning on many of the same technologies that power driverless cars. These include the 360-degree cameras and radar sensors built into the nose of the aircraft. And by the way, just so in case you Google it, Skyrise is spelled S-K-Y-R-Y-S-E. Again, it's a Silicon Valley company, Skyrise. There are many things that must come to fruition before autonomous aircraft start flying people, said Mark Golden. He's co-founder and the chief executive of Skyrise. And he adds, but we are developing the technology that can take us there. Sikorsky, a subsidiary of the defense contractor Lockheed Martin, and Zwing, another Silicon Valley startup, are fashioning similar technology. Others, including Aurora, a company now owned by Boeing, are exploring autonomous flight as they build a new kind of electrical aircraft, I should say, for flying taxi services. The initial business plan for Uber's air taxi service, which it hopes to start in 5 to 10 years, said it would even eventually remove pilots from the aircraft. The motivation is obvious. Pilots are expensive, and they need rest between flights. Autonomous flight could drive new kinds of passenger services or even change the economics of today's airlines. As companies like Aurora build aircraft for autonomous flight, entrepreneurs like Grodin believe that adapting existing aircraft is more realistic. But any path will take a while for technical and cultural reasons. This is not just about building something that can fly by itself, said Dan Patt, the chief executive of the robotics company Vecna, who previously worked on autonomous flying with Sikorsky and other companies while he was at DARPA, a research arm of the Defense Department. It is about building a body of evidence that this is a safe way to fly, he said. Government and industry have long worked to automate portions of passenger flight. Autopilot is part of the American vernacular, and in some ways, building an autonomous aircraft is easier than building driverless cars, which have long been tested on public roads. Aircraft operate in wide open spaces as opposed to narrow roads teeming with pedestrians and other vehicles. And piloting a plane or helicopter is the kind of highly procedural task that computers are typically good at. Tiny drones have already shown the possibility of autonomous flight. Skydio, a Silicon Valley startup founded by former Google engineers, sells a $2,500 drone that can follow you through a forest as you bob and weave between the trees. Adam Bry, the company's chief executive, who also worked on Google's delivery drone project, said the same general technology, based on digital cameras and mathematical systems that analyze images in real time, was suited to passenger aircraft. The technical challenge is a simpler in a lot of ways, Bry said. Nobody wants these things whipping through the forest as fast as they can go. They just want them to fly reliably, carry people from point A to point B, and deal with takeoff and landing. But dealing with the uncertainty that comes with during takeoff and landing, not to mention the rare and random events that cause crashes in the middle of a flight, can be extremely difficult. Passenger flight is also highly regulated, even if they build systems that fly reliably. Companies may have trouble moving the technology into public airspace. That is why Skyrise, backed by $25 million in funding, including investments from the Silicon Valley venture firms Venrock and Eclipse, is working with the city of Tracy. Now, the Tracy Emergency Service will operate under current federal rules, and it takes only a step toward autonomy. The helicopter includes sensors that would need for autonomous navigation. The radar, for example, is similar to the laser sensors on driverless cars, providing a detailed view of the surroundings even in heavy weather. But at this point, these sensors operate in tandem with pilots. PAC calls it a way of building trust with regulators. At the same time, these sensors capture enormous amounts of data describing what the helicopter encounters from takeoff to landing and how the pilot responds. Using this data, engineers at Skyrise are recreating flight conditions in a kind of virtual reality, and they're fashioning systems that can navigate these simulations. Driverless car makers rely on similar techniques. We can simulate puffs of wind, engine failure, even birds digested into the tail rotor, Groden said. But shifting this work into emergency services like the one in Tracy will take years. Moving it into flying taxi services may take even longer. The helicopters used by Skyrise, the four-seat Robinson R-44, are small and quiet by existing standards and in relatively wide use. About 6,000 have been built. But if used in large numbers, they may not be suited to densely populated areas. This is why companies like Aurora and the Silicon Valley startup Kitty Hawk are building a new kind of aircraft. Still, the biggest hurdle may be convincing regulators and the public that autonomous flight is safe. There are a lot of startups doing this, Igor Chikopinski, director of autonomy programs at Sigorsky, said. Quite a few of them are naive about what it will take, he added. Well, some great things ahead, huh? Just a few moments left in our clock here, so let's check on our calendar of Carolina events. This from the September-October 2018 issue of AAA Go Magazine, and we're going to head over to Albemarle, where on October the 26th and 28th, we have the Albemarle Craftsman's Fair at Knobs Creek Recreation Center. This is Albemarle Sound, I should say, not Albemarle, North Carolina, so let me make sure that's clear. And that's at Elizabeth City, and it's over 60 craftsmen selling their quality handcrafted items while demonstrating the creation of their wares. And there is a fee involved with this demonstration. And if you want to check it out online, AlbemarleCraftsmansFair.com. That's AlbemarleCraftsmansFair.com. Again, that's in Elizabeth City, North Carolina, October 26th through the 28th. And that brings us to the end of another episode of Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed today's episode and that you'll be with us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, reminding you the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. By the way, the broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. Comments and questions may be directed to 919-832-5138. Bye-bye.